You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and served numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hey guys, welcome to the Worldwide Will Show. If you've listened to this podcast before, you'll know that it's designed in order to tell people's life story. I believe everyone's life is a story, and it's down to them to tell it. So today I'm joined by...
Lisa Johnston.
Thank you, Lisa. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So where did it all start for you? Where was Homestead?
Home was a place called Hertfordshire, and in there was a little village called Watternut Stone in between Hertford and Stevenage.
Quite a small village.
Yeah, it was out in the sticks.
Yeah.
Probably a bit bigger now with all the housing and
developments and whatnot.
But when I was about 13, I joined the Army Cadets, and I thought, yeah, we're really, really good.
Yeah.
And at the time, my mum was a nurse, mm-hmm. and she'd work in a hospital, and she'd do the same thing day in, day out, and she said it got a bit boring. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I've always wanted to help people.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like I said, I was in the Army Cadets. I thought, well, you know, join the two together when I'm older.
Sure.
Be like a medic, paramedic in the field of combat.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I was 19, I joined the Army as a medic. RAMC in 2001.
Nice. So did you, I know you sort of in the cadets and stuff, did you know much about the military and especially the army, like the regimental structure and units available to women at that time?
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
All I did know was that when I was in the Army Cadets, we did so much fun stuff and, you know, running around with weapons and, you know, digging in camming up. And that was really quite interesting. And I knew that there were different types of jobs in the army. And I thought, well, again, not being a nurse, but I thought being paramedic.
Sure.
You know, so that combined the two. But when I joined, it was a bit different to what I thought, actually. Mm-hmm. So they do sell this amazing job.
Yeah.
But it does become a bit boring. But again, all jobs do, don't they?
Yeah. So 19, which training establishment did you go to? Was it
My training establishment was Lichfield. And then did 12 weeks there, your 3 months, passed out.
How did you find that at 19? All right. Were you one of the oldest there at that time?
I wasn't the oldest, I wasn't the youngest.
Yeah.
There was a couple of 18-year-olds, but there was a mixture of all sorts of people.
Right.
People who'd already got a trade and they were joining the army to do that trade. But no, it was just kind of a bit of a blur. Like, I'm going to be in the army.
How did you find it?
Oh, I loved it. Training was hard, don't get me wrong. I think I went in with my eyes shut.
Yeah.
And I found it harder. If I'd have prepared myself to go in, do a bit more fizz, then I would have been fine. But as a kid, you think, oh, yeah, smash
just
them all
like
off.
Yeah, fine.
Wing it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was quite hard work, but really enjoyed it. And, you know, they break you down.
Yeah.
To mould you into a soldier,
and
that's what they do.
Yep.
So that was phase one. My phase two training was at Keogh Barracks.
Yeah, I know it very well.
Oh, I think a lot of people know that very well, and not for good reasons.
I've got some stories from there.
there's a few stories, probably not best mentioning at all.
No.
But training there, I think, was 6 months. Mm-hmm. And it was both the RAF, the Army and the Navy.
And is that your trade training there?
That was trade training, yeah. And then halfway through, you split off to your single service. So the RAF would do their thing, mm-hmm. the medics do their, Army do theirs, and the Air Force do theirs. So after 6 months of that, I went to my first unit.
What sort of qualifications did you come out with after that 6 months? Because it doesn't seem very long time to
it
become
doesn't.
A medic.
Back then, they were saying they're in the process of doing an equivalent, a civilian equivalent recognisation. It's only in the last 5-6 years that they've actually happened. So we came out with qualifications that the army know about, but nothing civvy-wise.
It wasn't
recognised at all. So if we went to get a job in Civvy Street, there was no civilian equivalent qualification. Mm-hmm. But now there is, which is good.
That's
and they,
awesome.
They come out as ambulance technicians or some sort of paramedic-y type thing.
And that's for combat technicians?
Combat technician, yeah.
And is that what you went in as? Because you have, in the military, you have, in the army, you have RAMC, which is Royal Army Medical Corps.
Well done, yeah.
And you have the other one, which are nurses, I think.
QANCs. Yeah, so that's it, Queen Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps.
Yeah, I wasn't going to spill that
out. Yeah, no, you struggled with the RAMC. So they were the two main.
So one's like combat medic, the other one is. Like
nursing. So qualified nurses, mm-hmm. and they are civilian recognised.
That's interesting. So, like, what at that time, one was recognised, one wasn't, which is madness, really. Because surely engineers have their civilian qualifications from engineering.
Yep.
Same with the REMI, with their mechanical engineering. And yet, combat technicians.
We can even teach first aid. But yeah, that was our bread and butter.
Yeah, but now there is.
Now there is, yeah, which is long time overdue.
Yeah, can you sort of how do I put it? Our previous, so since you've been out, can you get the civilian equivalents, or do you have to do it all again? If that makes sense,
you'd probably have to start all over again. But they could fast track you because of the experience you've had.
Maybe go through certain modules quicker than that
they could just condense it down a bit and go over the important stuff. But a lot of it we covered. But unless, well, yeah, there is some sort of thing you can condense it down to.
Yeah. So you did your 6 months at Kiel Barracks. Where were you posted to? Were you broken down and sent to battalions, or was it an actual regiment and then?
Your first regiment generally, in fact, no, generally, is going to be a medical regiment.
Right.
So you put what you've learned into practice with people in a similar situation, and that's bog standard. So as a medic, you'll go to a medical regiment. My medical posting was, it was in Germany, and it was one close support medical regiment. So one CS Medreg.
How'd you find Germany?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, as a young Tom out there,
yeah,
it was the best posting ever. But to be honest, I probably used up all my nights out on the lash in the first couple of weekends. Because I think the first weekend I was there, we all went out, and it's completely different from UK. So I went to nightclub, and I remember having this card, and every time you had a drink, they did a hole punch. Mm-hmm. And so however many hole punches you had at the end of the night, you paid your... Your Deutschmarks back then.
Right.
And if you lost, inverted commas, your card, you just pay 50 Deutschmark. So we always lost our cards.
Of course you did, yeah.
But that weekend, the very first weekend, we went to the Elephant Bar, I remember that. And dancing away, having these old drinks, I'm thinking, it's starting to look a bit empty. The bouncers will start kicking us out soon. So I thought, wait, because that's generally what happens in the UK. And then dance around some more, had a couple more bevies, and it got a little bit empty, but still no bouncers ushering us out. And I looked at my watch, it's like 6:30 in the morning. Like, what? And it was then that I kind of realised, and someone told us, that the bar's shut when the last person leaves in Germany. I'm like, no way. Nobody told me that.
That's dangerous for a Brit.
I was really bad. I was absolutely hanging. I was kind of like, come over all tired, and I thought, really, I need to go back.
Yeah.
So I got a taxi back to camp, and walked into a cookhouse, still kind of like dressed for the night out, makeup smudged, kind of like feeling a bit worse for wear. I had a big fry up like you do. Went back to my room, I had a shower, stink of smoke.
Sure.
Oh, God, it was
stinking. I was smoked inside back then.
Yeah. And woke up about 5:00, went for dinner, did exactly the same thing.
Fuck.
And I've never been able to do it since. So I really do reckon I used up all my credits. In that first couple of weekends, but that was an incredible introduction to night out town in Germany.
So I was never posted in Germany, but obviously I did certain exercises, went over there, did a bit of training over there, and it is completely different world.
It is,
especially when guys don't go home, so that I think they bond better as well.
That's very true. That is very true. Generally on a Friday afternoon, early knock off, it was hells and farewells. So hello to the new guys and goodbye to the guys who were posted. And generally we'd be in one of the bay areas, and somebody get out a crate of beer like you do and start dishing it out and do a little speech, and then that was it, knock off at 12.
Yeah.
But I used to go up to the Brit Legion pub, and we'd go up there, again, still in uniform. I come out like 5 o'clock, really, really, you know, drunk.
Yeah.
Because three wickets and I was wasted.
Yeah.
I was a terrible drinker. It still hasn't improved.
Oh, you're still young. You're still young now, aren't you?
And, you know, so we'd go to the bar and we'd stagger home or back to the block, get changed and go straight to Naffy. It was incredible.
Yeah.
So as a young singly, experiencing life for the first time without being at home and not being having restrictions when you're in training, oh, you proper let your hair down.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose in training you're still almost classed as an inexperienced soldier, almost like a child as well.
Yes.
So when you get to your regiment, you're expected to be this soldier, this adult, and you're just like, what?
We got told we had a room inspection, and previous room inspections, you have your locker open, your bed made really nice and whatnot. So when first person came in for my room inspection, he's like, why have you got your locker open? I was like, well, this is a room inspection. And he's like, you're straight out of training, aren't you? I'm like, well, yeah. He goes, would you want me to look for your locker? I was like, well, not particularly, but it's nice and tidy for you too. He goes, look, shut your locker, because it's all different now. I said, you've done all your training, you've done this. You know, and I was quite taken aback because no one told you that.
Yeah.
You know, there's me dusting the old skirt and boards and whatnot.
Flapping.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we don't do that now. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Telling us.
This is the real army now. So you got to your regiment. How long before an operational tour came your way?
I was there for the first Optelec, and we were like, most of us were on leave and said, you know, got recalled back because we're off to on operations. And I thought, okay. But Telec, we always thought, who comes up with these names?
Yeah.
Well, Telec is tell everyone leave is cancelled. you can't make stuff like that up, can you? So we all got recalled and I was a bit nervous because I never knew what to expect. I didn't actually think I'd be in some sort of conflict.
Yeah.
But it was a real eye-opener. And I'll be forever grateful for that experience. But when we first got there, we went to Q8 and we had to, we were living in all these tents to acclimatise.
Yeah.
And then I remember there was this massive convoy. Oh, we were stuck in it for about 7 hours. And it was like bumper to bumper, going dead, dead slow. The song that we had playing on the radio or some speaker system was... I'm into the danger zone.
I think
that was from Top Gear,
Top Gun.
Yeah. So that was what we played. And then after about 5-6 times, it like got monotonous. We turned it off and it was just waiting. But I was absolutely busting for a pee. And being in this it was a soft top Land Rover. Yeah. And there was 1, 2, 3, 4. There was 5 of us in the back, the driver and then passenger. And we all scrunched up, we all got kit, water, food, rations, everything. I'm absolutely dying for a pee. And we couldn't go anywhere. So the only place we could go was it literally out the back because you couldn't go around the side because you didn't know if there was any mines or anything.
Yeah.
So I went out, dropped the kids. It was dark, so the lights were on and kind of like dropped kids out a really long way, splashed it around. I was like, and then I thought, shit, they can see me behind there. They've just got a full moon, full moon, up there and down there. And I'm like, great, but it was the best pee ever. Oh my God, it just wouldn't stop. But it was all that excitement and that. And I'm like, oh, and after that was fine.
Yeah.
And it took another couple of hours to get to where we were going.
Yeah. So on that tour of Iraq, were your unit attached to any certain battalions or were you like at a field hospital?
We were... I can't remember the name, it was that long ago. But we were part of field hospital. So my particular group was called Step Up, where our group and the Sergeant Major would go to the next location. They'd work out where the hospital were going to be, the entrance and the exits. And we'd set up this particular corridor and then the rest of the team will come in and then they build the hospital from that.
Yeah.
So we were called...
Like a central hub and they build out.
Yeah. Right. So we were called Step Up and that was our job. And to see an actual field hospital being made once it was up and running, it was quite incredible because I was 19 and I'd never seen anything epic like this. Yeah, we put up a bit of tentage in basic training, phase 2 training, you know, like you do.
But
on this scale, oh my God, it was incredible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then attaching the tents, so for an 18 by 24, become mm-hmm. a 18 by 48, yeah. and with the beds and the kit, and it was a real eye-opener. Mm. Really good, really good tour, that.
Bit warm.
Yeah, it was warm. However, to keep our water bottles cold, we used to put them in a sock.
Wet sock.
And then wet the sock and then leave in the wind. But if you left it too long, it'd get warm again. Mm-hmm. So you had to drink it.
Yeah.
But that was a really nasty tour for DMV.
Mm.
So first, when we were on individual rations, everyone was fine.
Yeah.
But then when the kitchen started popping up, and again, it was fly heaven. If you needed to go anywhere, like get a drink or get some butter, somebody would have to fly watch and swat the flies away from your dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But it was inevitable, and
a
lot of people came down with DMV, and that was a lot of people we saw.
The army sort of went downhill in terms of food when they changed it from the old system where it just came out of your monthly wage mm-hmm. and you could just take as much as you wanted.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you're doing vigorous training, you just eat like a monster.
Oh, gosh, of course you do.
And then they changed it to pay as you dine. We call it pay as you starve because that's exactly what happened. And for me, I think it was, I'm sure it was Sodexo that was on the camp that I was on. You know, they'd be like, they'd have little pots of tuna and say, well, that's like 28 grams of protein of what you're entitled to. And they'll charge like £1.20.
It was ridiculous. And the quality of food went downhill so bad.
Yeah. Well, because they're a for-profit business.
Of course they are.
So they would have written in a contract, like, yeah, we'll provide daily 30 grams of protein, 50 grams of carbs, in one meal, and some moron up at MOD would be like, yeah, that's fine. It was clearly not fine.
But that was kind of under the core meal, the core menu.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a bit of this, bit of that, bit of the other, but it was absolute dog poo.
Yeah.
Or you could pay extra for the really nice-looking, unhealthy stuff, which...
Which everyone did.
Yeah, because it was filling.
Yeah.
And then, because it was pay dine, some soldiers couldn't finance themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And halfway through a month, they had no money.
Yeah.
And that's where the embarrassing bit that came out. They'd go to the admin office and say, look, can I have a food chit or something? I forgot what it was.
Hungry soldier or...
Yeah. Hungry soldier, piece of paper. And then at the end of the month, when they got paid... That would be deducted from them, so there'd be...
So it's a knock-on effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially when, you know, if you think you're spending £3 or £4 per meal per day, you know, that's £12 a day for 30 days.
Mm.
That's a lot of money, especially for a private soldier who gets paid fuck all as it is.
That's true. That is true.
But in a way, it does teach you money management.
I remember people selling mm-hmm. computer games or TVs or a sofa because they had no money to eat, but mainly go out on the lash.
On the piss, yeah.
Yeah.
Or selling bits of kit.
Get charged for that, it's fine.
Yeah, that's right. It'll come out of my wages, it's fine. so we're on the Iraq tour. What year was that, if you want me to ask you?
I was on 2003 and 2009. Oh, I saw a big difference.
Oh, imagine.
Massive difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the first tour, going back to the old bathroom in,
mm-hmm.
my first experience of a toilet was a big wooden box
mm-hmm.
held over a trench,
mm-hmm.
held over, which was placed on two planks of wood so mm-hmm. it didn't fall down.
Mm-hmm.
And there weren't male or female. So I'd go have a quick wee and then some big guy will come along. Take down his kid, sit next to him. You all right, love? And you think, really? And
that's very progressive.
I mean, I wouldn't have minded, but I was left speechless. Yeah. And I think that probably scarred me a little bit. I was like, I'm never going to get that out of my head.
This new young generation think they're the first to make unisex toilets. Sorry, guys, get to it. And you won't like it.
No, they won't. And then the old flies hang around your bum hole and, you know, you've got to be quick, otherwise, you just feel them.
Otherwise they'll get you.
Yeah, nasty. So, yeah. And then on the last tour I did with them, it was like Butlins. You had, the rubber mats
mm-hmm.
with holes in, I don't know what they're called, but they were marked on paths and there was like little lights next to them as if you were walking down to the clubhouse or something. We had proper toilets, proper showers, completely different.
From See, that the first was American intervention in terms of.
No, I think it was because Iraq had been happening for so long. Yeah, they got good stuff in.
Yeah.
But my first shower on my first tour, it was a solar shower bag mm-hmm. on a scrim pole held on part of the Bedford. It mm-hmm. slipped in. And we had a bucket, yep. but not a bucket, more like a bowl. Mm-hmm. And we stood in that, and the arch of the Bedford, mm-hmm. where you put your shampoo and your conditioner and your wash, and then literally shower on, quickly wet yourself down, shower off,
yeah,
wash your hair.
Soap yourself up.
Shower on, wash it all off, and then shower off, and then make sure you've got everything. But as my group, we were pretty switched on because we were that separate step up group. We had our own kit and our own truck, so we were one of the first ones. I think we were out there about a week and a half. Yeah.
Yeah.
We were out there about a week and a half, and we were the first people to have a shower. And when you walk by people, they were like, oh, you smell nice. I'm like, oh, no, I've just had a shower. It was great. It was, like I said, as a young Tom out there, massive eye-opener, loads of great experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you couldn't get away with stuff like that now.
Yeah, yeah.
Just health and safety and all that kind of shit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like my first tour, we'd be lucky if I had one shower a week, one every 2 weeks. And then down Gormsea, it was got that scarce. We had to use the canal water, to drink purified canal water, which the locals shit in, and quickly run to the actual canal to have a quick shower in the canal.
Nice.
Or a solar shower, which is like one every 2 weeks.
Or squatty shower, which normal people do, is baby wipe, boom.
Yeah, well, we just sacked off the urgent then as well. Just pointless, trying to mask it.
Did you turn your grollies inside and out and wear them back to front?
Nah.
Get more days out of them?
Lucky enough, we just washed them. We just washed them. You don't want to go down with crotch itch, that's for sure.
Oh, gosh.
Bad admin.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was the early years of Afghan. I didn't do an Iraq tour, so all mine were Afghan, three Afghan tours. All summer as well, lucky enough.
Oof.
Fuck the winter in Afghan.
Yeah, it wasn't nice in winter, was it?
No. Could you notice a difference in terms of, like, kinetic activity as well? Was the first tour quite peachy, or...?
My first encounter on the first Iraq tour was... there were a lot of gas type mm-hmm. instances. They saw a plane, it was gas. Or they heard something, it was all... Because it was all quite mm-hmm. new and, mm-hmm. We spent hours in our reses.
Well, I mean... You know, Saddam had a track record of chemical weapon attacks, so...
But I think it was... Prevention's better than a cure.
Sure.
So being overcautious was probably really mm-hmm. good. So that was a lot was happening.
Yeah.
And then we did have a couple of mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And we were outside the burn area. We were doing, like, a bit of pre-training. Mm-hmm. What's it called? Optag.
Yeah.
Yeah, Optag training. And... all of a sudden this alarm went off and we had to go and jump in the old trenches that we'd done. But some people, instead of running all the way around, thought go over the burns and trying to walk up sand and climb over sand that's just not out enough. I was one of those idiots who did that as well. Sweating my ass off. And no matter how fast I was climbing up this sand bank, I just couldn't get over.
It's like
a treadmill. Yeah, it was. So someone at the top was like just grabbing your kit and throwing you over, and they were doing that. And you know, if it weren't for that guy, whoever it was, it was like a hand from God getting me over. And then obviously the first trenches were always full, so you had to run the other side of the camp to jump in a trench. So that was my first real panic.
Yeah.
Like, shit, nothing like that's happened before. And and we didn't even have, back then, we didn't have body armour. We were called the Borrowers, weren't we? We had no kit. We were out there in green kit. We had no boots. Boots were melting.
Yeah.
Oh, like it was
the poor cousins of the Americans.
We had no bog roll. Good job we got rat packs every day, because it's the old Kleenex in there that mm-hmm. sufficed.
Mm-hmm. Well, not that. Like, you end up stealing kit. Like lunatics.
Well, you borrow it on permanent loan.
Yeah.
So, or 1033 it out and just rip up 1033.
Or the Americans loved swapping
the MREs.
Kit, didn't they?
Yeah. Or they liked our kit, our food, and
I don't know why
they had some really good food.
Meatballs and pasta for breakfast.
Yeah, it was
mental.
And the way they cook it, add a bit of water in this bag.
Yeah.
Boom, it's sorted.
Yeah.
How easy was that? None of this messing around with mess tins and cooking and wiping the.
They
get proper looked after. They do.
They had it squared away, that's for sure. But they had a budget for it.
Yes, that's true.
You know, we have to pay our generals and keep paying them once they retire and stuff. So, you know,
pay the pen pushers who say yes.
You know, we've got to keep them in. We've got to keep the money coming in for them, haven't we?
Yeah.
So, 2009, was that a similar role 2003?
It was a very similar role, although I was before I went out there, I was attached to the Five Rifles. Mm-hmm. And that was my second posting. It was my real posting to attached arms. And mm-hmm. Oh my God, it was the best posting I ever had. I tell you something, a bored soldier is a dangerous soldier. I had so many, I learned so much, both medically, physically, socially, just everything.
The way I describe it is go to a zoo and watch a bored ape. It will just do something mental.
Oh, we went to the Falkland Islands and I was doing the old first aid teaching and that kind of stuff. And one of the guys took me to one side and asked me something medical. And when I came back in, I saw, you know, Annie, Misati Annie, mm-hmm. on the floor with some guy's kegs around his ankles, teabagging her face. And I'm like, for those who don't know what teabagging is, do you know, I'm not even going to describe it because it's just...
Go on Urban Dictionary and type it in.
Google it, teabagging.
Teabagging.
And I came in and the look of shock on his face was like, oh, you're right. I'm like, what the fuck do you think you're doing? He's like, oh, well, I was just... He had no words. I was like, right. I said, sort yourself out. You can give her mouth to mouth now. He goes, oh, have you got any wipes? I'm like, no. Have a fuck. You can stick your lips round where you've stuck your bits and you can give her mouth to mouth and show how you do CPR. And he was like, oh, I've had worse. And I was like, the mentality. And I thought, that was so funny.
Yeah.
And there was another time we, on a rare time off we had, we were able to go to Sea Lion Island and saw the penguins and whatnot. And it was, you know, penguins, I know now, when they defecate, mm-hmm. it's projectile out there. Mm-hmm. They lay on the tummies and they just projectile out there. I was like, I wondered what all these splat works were.
Yeah.
So I learned that. That was eye-opening. But there were these massive sea elephant or elephant seals.
Right.
And they were laid behind these big, big sandbanks. And again, bored squaddy, dangerous squaddy. Some of these guys thought it'd be funny to go up to the other side of the sandbank, sit down, and then use their hands as to hold them up and then work their feet out onto these massive elephant seals. And it was whoever stays there the longest or doesn't die wins. And I was like, you do that in my presence. I said, I've had enough. I said, it's time off. I am not going to deal with
your
shit.
You're
almost
like a mother.
I don't, I just complete disbelief.
Probably good training for motherhood, though.
They were the size of cars and they were playing death. It was fun. It was one of those where you shouldn't be watching and you were laughing, but you couldn't tear your eyes away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you think, shit, if this goes wrong, they're dead.
Yeah.
So, yeah, some great, great times. Yeah. And there was this one medical experience as well, which I learned very early on. I saw a patient mm-hmm. and he says, I've got a bit of a sore in the groin area. I thought, okay, no problem. Jump up on the bed and drop your kids. We'll have a look. Biggest mistake, the thing I should have asked was, are you wearing any underwear? I did not ask that question. He dropped his kegs and his tackle waggled out and I was like, really?
Nice surprise.
Bit of a blue towel. Here you go, love. Put that over your bits. So, you know, it doesn't wink at me. And so very early on, I learned about asking if they wear an underwear. And some people who did come through and they did have to drop kegs for whatever reason... Yep. The types of underwear was very questionable. I'd seen pretty pink thongs, silky lacy ones, and I'm thinking, trying to be professional and not point and laugh and piss myself laughing. And I'm like, really? And they're like, I'm wearing it for a dare, or my girlfriend's looking for it. And I was like, don't have to explain yourself to me, mate. Yeah. I know. So I had some good times.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite times was probably vaccination parades because you go through your med stats and mm-hmm. people do jabs and people need to do this. And you get these big, heavily tattooed guys come in, you know, rah, ugh type thing. Mm. You'd be like, you're right with needles. Yeah, I'm right. Needles got tattoos everywhere. Da-da-da-da-da. Show the needle, do the squirt, and they'd keel over. Really? Yeah, covered head to toe in tattoos and one little needle and you flake. Wuss. Absolute wuss. Had no sympathy from me.
So was that your role, like, when you were attached? So it'd be general healthcare and...
Yeah, but loads of healthcare during the first uh-huh. morning. Uh-huh. And then there was loads of teaching. Mm-hmm. And then there was loads of med covers. Mm-hmm. So that was the general kind of thing. So I really enjoyed that kind of time and that type was environment.
Between tour one and tour two. What that was it?
That was between tour. Yeah. So when I went out on tour two, mm-hmm. although I was catered in for the infantry, yeah. I was kind of still in that position. So my current unit didn't have me. I was working mm-hmm. with the old infantry, mm-hmm. and I was in the MIT medical team. Mm-hmm. MIT. I don't know what it stands for. I'm sure I did one point.
Yeah. Probably changed now, anyway.
Yeah. So we were in the main camp, and I'd do the daily sick parades yeah. and lame soldiers that were coming in. Mm-hmm. And because it was quite a quiet tour, the beginning was very quiet, I'd had patients come in saying, I've got excessive sweating. I was like, all right, it's PTI, comes in, I've got excessive sweating. Okay, mate, do you shave? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, have you been here long? Oh, no, I'm pretty new. I'm like, well, kind of acclimatised to the environment, mate. He goes, I've got this special deodorant. And I'm like, did you bring your 6 months with you like you're supposed to? If you're on particular medications, you bring 6 months' worth. No. Well, then, fuck off. I said, you're wasting my time. I said, you should have had your admin squared away. Go away. And it was stuff like that. I had no time for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you ain't, like, dying...
It's all about self-help as well, though, you know?
It is.
You knew about it, you should have taken it.
And you'll find sympathy between shit and syphilis in dictionary. I'm so unsympathetic. Not good.
I think it helps with the trade, though, right?
It does, yeah. But towards the end of that tour, the Americans were taking over. So that's when we got a bit of loud flashbangs and stuff. Because, again, we were quite quiet, but as soon as the Americans start coming in... They started bringing all their trucks. They were making a big stage for the CSE mm-hmm. show. Mm-hmm. They were bringing in food.
Pizza.
Trailers. And so once all that kind of started happening, there were more attacks.
Yeah, yeah.
So, that wasn't a fun tour.
Do you think that was just because they were American or because they had a bigger presence? Or?
I think it was because a bit of both. Mm-hmm. One, because the Americans, mm-hmm. but... The more kit, I mean, if the aerial view, you see the amount of kit they were bringing in. And their accommodation, we had like coffins.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And they had like bunk beds and wardrobes and furniture you could actually sit on. And I'm like, what? We had a bit of these stones under a coffin and and whatnot. Oh,
How they operate.
Is completely different. They don't slum it at all.
Yeah, do it en masse as well.
Yes.
En masse.
Why can't we do that? Was it the army dig in, the RAF check in? Comes to mind.
And the Navy's not even there. Sorry, guys.
They were there. They were in their army kind of like uniform. Ah, right. And they were stacking on. So they're doing army stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So they felt quite useful.
Yeah. We love you, really. So back from... which telec was that?
That was telec 9 going into 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense because...
We all pulled out after that.
2009 was Herrick 10 as well, so that makes sense.
Mm.
So, come back from Iraq. What was it like for you coming back from Iraq? Were you going back to Germany or back to the UK?
I was posted back to the UK. I was with 2-2 Field Hospital.
Yeah.
Which was... I said cushy little posting. It's quite a small unit, and because it is so small, you kind of know everybody. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it. I really did enjoy it. Again, it was working with hospitals, and in the winter time, like you do, they send you on exercise. Yep. So
straight back from Iraq to the UK. Had you met hubby at this point?
Yes, I met hubby when I was in. Not on my first tour, mm-hmm. I'd known of him,
yep.
but met him towards the end of my first posting
right.
in Munster, which yep. was 1CS, and then I went to Five Rifles. And when we went to Five Rifles, we got married.
Oh, lovely.
So we had a straight from a block into yep. a pad, and it was great.
Yeah.
So
a bit of independence as well.
Yeah. So, we'd been married a couple of years by then. We had Adam, he mm-hmm. was about two.
Mm-hmm. What was that like, being a mother and... soldier.
Hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. Your heart says, screw it, get out.
Yeah.
You know, you're a mum.
Yeah.
But then you join the army, I joined the army because that's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I always said
that's who you were.
Yeah, it was. In even my leaving book at school, saying what you want to do when you leave school, it was like, paramedic in the army, mm-hmm. and that was when I was about 15, 16. Mm-hmm. So it was hard.
Yep.
And, you know, we kept in touch. You had not so much mobiles, but you had the internet, you had mm-hmm. e-blueies, mm-hmm. you had mm-hmm. actual blueies, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. So I got a lot of pictures sent through and laminated and mm-hmm. stuck on a pin board. So it was hard.
Yeah, yeah.
I did speak to him every so often, so it was good.
And did he understand the fact that mum's in the army and that's what she does?
Because he was about two, I don't really think he missed me, like, out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
But for me, it was really, really hard. And I'd ask for his how his progress.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a story, hang on, another story. He'd go to nursery.
Yeah.
And, like you do, he... Hubby had finished, he'd been on an exercise, mm-hmm. and so my mum or his mum had Adam. And when he came back off exercise, they had to leave and said, look, we've got to go, Adam's yours, sorted. Mm-hmm. And he could just come off exercise, he'd been away for about 3 weeks, hanging out of his hoop hole mm-hmm. like you are, mm-hmm. falls asleep on the sofa. He wakes up to Adam poking him, saying, dad, 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 dad. And he wakes up and there's this brown stuff everywhere. He had stripped off, he'd taken off his nappy, he'd got lots of kind of mess, and he was rubbing it in the TV, it was in the TV unit, it was on the sofa, it was in the carpet, and he just looked, he didn't know where to sit, so he picked him up, chucked him in the bath, and then when I rang, he told me what had happened, and I had to put the phone down because I was laughing so hard. Yeah, I had to ring about 10 minutes later, I was like, oh my God, that's so funny!
It's like a great story to tell at a kid's wedding.
Definitely. And, sorry, I digress.
It's all right. It's all right. So at what point did you become injured? I believe it was a PT sesh.
Yeah. There's in 2000 and... Oh, I'm not quite sure. When I came back from the third... from the telic.
Yeah.
I was doing lots of training. I was dead fit and mm-hmm, whatnot. Mm-hmm. From running out there to running back here... There was a vast difference because mm-hmm. you're running on kind of like dirt, sand, kind mm-hmm. of quite soft. Mm-hmm. So when I came back, I was started running on roads and I started getting a bit of shin pain. And like you do, medic, oh shit, go to doc, get a biff chip sorted until you rest. While I was on a light duty performer, as they are called, and I can't call them biff chips.
Yeah, 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 sure.
My unit made us do a tab.
Oh shit.
So that it wasn't just me, it was like everybody was on parade. Right, we've got everybody here. Surprise, we're going to do a tab. Or they said a brisk walk. So we did that. And
but even though...
sick, lame and lazy. Everybody had a chit. There was a biff wagon following us as well. People were dropping out like flies because, one, people hadn't prepared. They weren't wearing the right foot kit.
Yeah, but surely that sort of doctor's note, if you want to turn it into civvy speak, was exempt you from
You'd think activities. That, wouldn't you? That's what's supposed to happen. They're supposed to go off the chit and say, actually, you can
what
do that,
can,
you
what
can't
can
do
you
that.
Can't do, yeah.
Or go to the gym and do just upper body mm-hmm. or just lower mm-hmm. body. No, none of that happened. So that was my first kind of real injury.
Wow.
And that put me up, mm-hmm. me out a lot. So I went back to the, I went to the doctor and said, look, they've made me do this. I've done a tab. I'm an absolute clip. So that put me out of normal PT for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then months on, getting a bit better, progressing really, really well, still under a physio's. My unit at the time, I'm not going to mention the unit.
Sure.
We were doing, it was the commanding officer's last kind of big exercise before mm-hmm. being posted.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was involved, even, they called it the biff group. So all the sick, lame and lazy, anybody with injuries, backs, legs, mm-hmm. ankles, non-freezing cold injuries, any injury you got, was in my section, and I was section commander, and I was like, look, we can't do some of the stuff that you're telling us to do.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can do everything just at a walking pace. So never mind that you're carrying extra kit, you're carrying extra this. And it was a big old cluster.
Yeah.
But we were made, again, to do this. And we're doing pairs under fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy in charge was like, come on, get yourself up, get yourself shooting, sort yourself up.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't move that fast. A lot of people got re-injured on that day, and there was a few service complaints that went in because of the mass of injuries that were reoccurred.
What year was this, if you want me to ask you?
This was 2000 and probably 10 or 11. So risk assessments were done and risk assessments were ignored.
Ooh.
Again. So this is my experience being injured.
Yeah. What rank were you at that point?
I was...
Pretty corporal, that's corporal.
I think I was a full screw.
Yeah.
So yeah, something like that. So that was another experience of medical advice not being adhered to.
Yeah.
Cut long story short, I'd popped out two kids. When I say popped out two kids, there's like 11 months, 2 weeks between both of them. So I tipped up to work 6 months pregnant.
Yeah.
And they were like, haven't you just? I'm like, yeah. Aren't you now? Yeah. You need to get a TV. So I had that kind of stigma. So I came away, went on maternity leave, shebang. And then after maternity leave, I came back to work and... Cut long story short, not going into too much detail, I did a PT lesson and I got injured. Normal PT lesson. And it was a type of injury that I kind of didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
I did an assault course.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the doctor. I said, look, something does, it hurts. My legs hurt, but something doesn't quite feel right.
Right.
And she's like, usual stuff, couple of Brufen, week off.
Tuba grip.
Yeah, Brufen, tuba grip, the shebang. But over time, a couple of weeks, going to a couple of months, something in my left leg just was cruciatingly painful.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to explain this to somebody that the leg looks normal.
Yeah.
There's no, it's had scans, had x-rays, everything kind of looked normal, but apart from this pain.
Mm.
And they said, oh, it's in your head. There's nothing wrong with you. Go, you know, another couple of weeks off light duties and more tablets. This went on for quite a while.
Mm.
And over time, my leg started to change ever so slightly, but I could see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I was in a cold environment, my leg, it'd be swollen by this time. My leg would go like a really deep mottled purple colour.
Mm, wow.
And if I was in like a warm environment, it'd go like a bright red stinging kind of sensation. But it was really bizarre. My toenails just grew and grew and grew. They were like superly fast growing. It was
like talons.
Yeah, like claws. And my leg was cold to the touch when I could touch it. But I couldn't look at it. I couldn't touch it. I couldn't shower. The shower would feel like hot fat.
So to touch it, it hurt as well.
Oh, God, yeah. I couldn't really do much. And I got a diagnosis of CRPS, which is complex regional pain syndrome.
Right.
And it's a neurological pain condition that over-exaggerates pain.
Right,
so, okay. For example, you stub your toe.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts, but the pain dies down. But with CRPS, the it really hurts, it doesn't go and it stays and it gets louder and louder and stronger. So over a period of months, my leg went to like a balloon.
Mm.
And like I said, I couldn't touch it.
So with the body, not only with the pain, but with the body's response to an injury, like with the swelling and whatnot, would that increase as well?
Yeah. My skin, it started like flaking off.
Mm-hmm.
The foot would swell. It looked like I had a cankle. It looked like somebody had injected a load of fluid and it was fit to pop.
Wow.
That's what it were like. And because I kept taking pictures, I could see the change. I can understand from a medical point of view when you get somebody to keep coming back to you, the story's not the same.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You think, oh, they're making it up. But with CRPS, it wasn't the same every day.
Yeah.
If it was about to rain or there was clouds in the air, there'd be like a really deep, deep, deep thudding ache on top of this pain. So it was a really, really bizarre thing. So once I had this diagnosis, I'd never heard of it. So I Googled it like you do.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like reading a pamphlet of what I had. I was like, oh, my God, I've got that. Oh, my God, I've got that. And I'm thinking, why hasn't anybody picked it up sooner? The physio had picked it up sooner. After three weeks after my injury, the physio said she suspected CRPS.
But it wasn't investigated further from that point?
Well, the doctor shot it down. In my notes, it said that it was completely dismissed. I know. So it started off in my ankle, went up to my shin, and then it started going up to my knee joint.
Mm-hmm.
But over this time, I was at Headley Court.
Yep.
And... we tried treatments, we tried topical treatments, medical treatments, physio, acupuncture, mirror therapy, water therapy, everything you could try, we tried, and it just wasn't working. and the fog I was in, it was like I was a dribbling zombie. Mm. I couldn't function. I couldn't remember people. I couldn't remember people's names. It was like swimming in treacle, but with hazy over your eyes. You couldn't see, think, feel. All that there was this pain.
From the pain or like from medication in order? Did they give you medication to try?
Pain from the leg. Mm-hmm. But with the amount of drugs they were trying to pump into us, that not complicated things, but that didn't help because the pain meds didn't touch it.
Sure.
And with the amount of drugs you're on, it affects your body, like it clogs your insides up, you get shakes, you get sweats. So there is a reaction to the drugs that you're on. So for a couple of years, to and from Headley, I'd have like 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off. And with Ethan being so young, every time I went away, he couldn't understand why I went away because he's got learning difficulties.
Yeah.
So when I did come back, he'd be like, "Oh, who are you?"
type
thing, and that bond had to be remade.
Yeah.
And I think looking from his eyes to me, he just saw a person who was always yelling, who was always grumpy, who wouldn't let anybody near me because I had like this invisible circle around me that no one could enter because I was in absolute petrified that they'd cause me more pain.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a way to live. It was more existing than living.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some real dark times there. Yeah, real dark times.
Can imagine.
So, yeah, that was my original injury. So a couple of years later, after going for all these treatments, there was nothing else left to do. And they said the next pragmatic step was amputation.
Fucking hell.
Really? You know, and for so long we were like trying to keep this leg, but quality of life against that, it was a bit of a no-brainer, but it took me so long to get my head around it. If the leg had gone, then I could be better. But if they could take the leg and it could not go away, but it was a 50-50 chance.
Had they said that?
Yeah, they said even with amputation, the CRPS could still be there.
Shit.
And they gave me a 50-50 chance, and I was thinking, well, that they're good odds in my eyes.
Yeah.
So.
I suppose when you're in so much pain as well, I mean, probably any percentage is something to cling on to in terms of positive percentage.
I was living from appointment to appointment.
Yeah.
And that was how we lived our lives for a couple of years. And it got to a point where I was done. I had nothing left.
Yeah.
And so they prepare you by counselling and talking to people and that kind of thing. And originally it was supposed to be a through knee.
Right.
So they just... Again, says it on the tin.
Yeah.
So they just go through your knee, so no bones above your femur come away, and just take your leg. 20 minutes before I went down to surgery, the surgeon came out and she spoke to somebody at Headley and discussed the type of amputation, and it came about that a transfemoral would be better. Transfemoral is above knee, so they go through your femur.
Yep.
And so 20 minutes before I went down, they said, "Oh, we're doing transfem," and I was like, "Oh, yeah, whatever, I'll just do it."
Yeah.
And not realising the impact it would have. Because if you've got a knee or below knee, you've still got a functioning part of your body. Yeah. But having no knee on one side, it's a whole new kettle of fish. But I went down, had surgery, come out of it. Once I was off all the drugs after a few days, it was like a massive weight had lifted. The invisible circle around me that was there for so long, it just evaporated. Because, don't get me wrong, I was in absolute agony, but it was a different type of pain. It was surgical pain, that type of thing, but not the CRPS pain. And since then, life has got 100% better because I don't live this pain 24/7.
That's such a crazy thing. So, was it like a phenomenon that it was like the injury triggered this?
Yeah. The scary thing is that any type of injury could cause CRPS, and it's so unknown and a misunderstood injury. While I was at Headley Court, I met several people with the same thing.
Wow.
And we were like, where else in the world would we ever come across it? No one's ever heard of it.
Was it quite nice seeing someone else going through a similar thing in terms of like, you explain to someone, they're like, that sounds crazy.
It was more, you felt as if it is happening to somebody else. So you know it's not, in your head. You know that you've not been making this up. Because for a long while, I thought I was going crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because so many people saying there's nothing wrong. You're making it up.
It's in your head.
It's in
your
head.
Especially professionals saying it as well.
Yeah. And you think, shit, something is probably really wrong with me because nobody else can see it.
Yeah.
But having other people have it, yeah, it's shit. But kind of made you feel better because it is there and it is a real thing and other people do have it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But 99% of people, you ask what CRPS is, they've never heard of it.
Oh. I'll admit, I've never heard of it.
And it's such a misunderstood injury that a lot of people, especially in the army or military, people need to be aware of it because it can be cured. If you catch it within 0 to 3 months, you have your proper treatment, it can be cured. 3 to 6 months, it's like a 50-50 chance. 6 months plus, it's more of managing it.
Right.
And I got diagnosed at the 7th or 8th month.
Yeah.
And by then, the damage was done. And trying to reverse all the symptoms and the and the way your brain rewired, you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So CRPS is definitely a real thing. You speak to anybody about it and they can't even describe the pain. I'll try to. Like, you ever stepped on Lego?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, if not, you will step one off. Like that, but on fire. Or it's like having your foot in a fire, millions of paper cuts, salt spread into it using sandpaper, and that's not even touching the tip. I've got no erase to describe it.
Yeah, and there's nothing you can do about it.
And there's no painkillers touched. There's no respite. There's no relief. There's absolutely nothing you can do.
I suppose it was affecting your sleep as well, was it?
Oh, God, I was like a walking zombie.
Yeah.
I had a bed frame, so the bed cover couldn't touch it. But trying to put your leg down in a position where it doesn't touch anything, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So I was always flinching. I couldn't put my foot down. It was exhausting.
Yeah. So I suppose towards the end you were just like, just get it off.
Done.
Yeah. I don't blame you.
It does have other problems though, but they're more manageable than CRPS, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I remember we touched on it earlier on, sort of the psychological effects of the amputation itself. Sort of like with any amputation, there will be some sort of depression or some slight negative mental health.
I had a lot of that before even the amputation, because
you're already living it with the pain and stuff.
I was living some real dark days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'd kind of had all that, and once I had my amputation, that was slowly lifting, because I wasn't in that constant agony.
Sure.
I actually got good sleep, and so these little factors, I was. With the CRPS, I was slowly coming out of that fog and reducing my meds, not like immediately, but every couple of weeks I'd say, actually, I don't feel like I need to take this. Can I reduce it? So we start reducing meds and then eventually stop. So
the specialist aware of the sort of negative effects it has on mental health? Were they managing it? Were they aware of the...
I was seeking counselling and psycho people, psychologists, there we go. So I was being very well looked after. So that was really, really good, that end. But I was on such a natural high because of this new lease of life, even though I had no leg and I was in a bit of pain. But it was like I was optimistic.
Sure.
There's hope. There is like definitely a brighter future.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was on this natural high for a long, long while, a couple of months. And then on a weekend home, I went to Sainsbury's and there was a bunch of youths on the bench, and they were probably about 15 to maybe 17, 18. And they said some really nasty stuff to me. And I was like, it was like smack in the face. And I was like, shit. And I saw it from their eyes and I felt absolutely awful.
Yeah.
And that's when I had more anxiety. I never used to have anxiety. But I had more anxiety and I was like, oh, shit, you know, I am disabled. I am a cripple. I can't. That's fucking my life outrageous. Is over.
Yeah.
So from coming out from really, really low to a natural high to have somebody piss on my bonfire.
Yeah.
It was a roller coaster of emotion, and it took me a good couple of months. About 4 or 5 months to come out of that.
Yeah.
And it really did knock me back.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It really did.
I can imagine.
Bastards. I'd thank them now, because it makes you stronger, you know. What don't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah.
And it's how you perceive people now.
Well, karma.
It is, karma's
a fucker, and they'll learn.
I had people, after that incident, I had real issues with people staring at me.
Yeah.
And I'd get really anxious, and I'd start like... and so I had to figure out a way, instead of just talking about it, I had to figure out a way to cope with it. And because my stump was changing size, it rapidly reduced in size from the swelling. So every couple of 3 weeks, I'd have a new socket fixed. And so combined in the two, I went on the internet. I ordered a couple of, you know, the cloth badges that you can iron on.
Yeah.
I ordered something like Superman, Batman, Smurfette, Pac-Man, Buzz Lightyear, Peppa Pig, all that kind of stuff. And I placed it where I wanted to do, gave it to my prosthetist, and they kind of made it happen.
That's awesome.
And I got some really amazing casts out of that. But for me, it was like a conversation starter.
Yeah.
So I did it with kids. A lot of kids would stop and stare.
Because they're inquisitive, aren't they?
They are. Actually. And they're not mean or anything. No, they just haven't seen something. So as soon as I'd see some kids stopping and pointing to their mum would be like, oh, shh, don't say anything. And I was like, no, come on. Here we go. And I'd take my leg off and I'd say, which one's your favourite? And we'd talk about it. So that got me used to dealing with that situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were only kids, but it gave me a bit more confidence when adults were looking.
Yeah.
My kids, they were a bit conscious about it, but hubby picked on it massively, and he felt really uncomfortable that people were staring. And I was like, babe, it's fine. And he could say, look, just what you're staring at.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of over-ish that now. Yeah. I've got into a routine where I go places where I know people, so I don't get initial stare. But sometimes I just have to take a step back, and I'm like... deep breath. It's right. They're only looking. They're only looking. They're inquisitive, and sell for it that way.
Yeah. But I suppose if you're flowing in confidence as well, then they're just like, holy shit, check her out.
Sometimes it comes across, I'm really confident. I've got no one to kick me down.
Yeah.
But looks can be deceiving.
Sure.
On the inside, you could be screaming.
Yeah, totally.
And you know, sometimes, like I said, I do come across as really confident, but deep down, it's just a mess.
Yeah.
But you don't show that. Mm-hmm. And if people, it depending on who says, how you doing, say if it's like, a relative, a family member, how you doing? Oh, yeah, I'm fine, I'm sorted. You know, an acquaintance, how you doing? Oh, it's fucking shit, I just, rah! And then somebody you don't know, you're out, how you doing? So depending on who's asking the question, depends on what your answer, what your answer's going to be. Northern. So, yeah.
Mega. So you sort of, you've broken the ice, what with the patches and the badges on your leg, what with the kids and stuff. Adults, it's a bit harder.
Adults is a bit harder, yeah. But I've, like I said, I've grown used to that now. Yeah. And a couple of good things have come out of it. In fact, a couple of bad things have come out of this. Mm. My kids have been targeted for bullying.
You're joking.
Nope. The nastiness about, your mum's got a fake leg, your mum's a cripple, all that. I can't imagine what it goes through. Charlie was getting this particularly, and he came home and he got really, really upset. Yeah. I said, darling, I said, sticks and stones, break your bones and all that. But it was coming up to like a parents' evening type thing, and we went in and we mentioned about Charlie's nasty comments. And she said, I'm more than happy to come in and explain and show and tell the kids why I am the way I am. And she was like, actually, there's Disability Awareness Week coming up. Do you mind coming in and doing a little talk for that?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, not a problem. So I did a little deaf by PowerPoint, although not quite deaf by PowerPoint like you do. I threw in a few pictures of my leg with CRPS and then a couple of pictures with me in the hospital with thumbs up. And then I threw in a few pictures of me doing activities that I'd done. And I'd never heard a group of kids so quiet, hanging on to every single word. And they were amazed. And a couple of pictures I put in was me on a trike, a recumbent trike. Mm-hmm. There's a really cool picture of me skiing on one leg. That's probably the only picture of me you've got, I mean, not face planting. Like. So that one looks really good. And there's a picture of me swimming and there's climbing ropes and all sorts of stuff. And I explained to them that, yeah, I can't do stuff the same as you, but there are other ways I can do it, but still do it. And they were mesmerised.
Do you know what you probably do in those from those presentations? You probably do more than the parents of the bully of the bullies.
You know? After that, Charlie was like, "Everyone thinks you're cool, Mum." I'm like, obviously, but you know, it's like Charlie's mum with a robot leg, and you know, I'm happy with that. And he's been left alone, and and that kind of stuff. But
I suppose it's all about awareness and education as well, isn't it?
It is. It's all about opening
eyes. Kids can be horrible. Kids can be horrendous. Adults can be even worse. But if you, like you said, if you just open their eyes to it,
well, we played a game, and it's like, right, everyone stand on one leg, easy peasy. I'm like, right, close your eyes while standing on one leg. There was a few wobbles. And I was like, right, take your shoes off, stand on that one leg, and without touching anybody or touching the floor or anything, take off the sock that you are standing on. And they were like, what? And I stood there, I took my sock off, and I was like, there you go, easy peasy. And they were like, whoa, wobbling all over the place. So they probably should have done a risk assessment, their heads banging. But they were like, wow. And it's little things like that. And I said, well, I have to stand on one leg when I'm in the shower. I have to do this on one leg. If I can't wear my leg or in my wheelchair, I'm on crutches. I have to have a lot of strength in that one leg. And they were blown away. And I showed them the types of legs I got. I've got a water leg that I use around the swimming pool area. The leg that I normally wear, which is microprocessor knee. I have a cosmetic leg, so it actually looks like a leg.
Oh, really?
With, you know, a wedding or something, a party, I want to look normal. And I've got a blade as well.
Awesome for running.
So that's pretty cool. That's cool. That's quite new.
That's awesome. So do you use that? I know we're probably going to go on to it in a minute, but the Invictus Games, is that the blade that's for sports?
It is for sports, yeah. One thing I was really, well, I go to the gym every day now.
Yeah.
But the reason why I go to the gym every day is to get out my house because I'm 2 years post, 2 years veteran, and my house still hasn't been adapted. And it felt like a prison. If I can't wear my leg and I can't use my wheelchair because the doors aren't wide enough, I became a prisoner. And I started eating crap. I was watching Netflix. I just on your phone, and I felt really, really bad. And I was in quite a dark place because I'd moved house, nothing had happened. I hadn't gone out and about because I was in a new area, didn't know anyone. And that anxiety about people looking, that resurfaced. And so it got to the point one day when I was going up the stairs on my bum.
Yeah.
I was hanging out my arse and I was like, oh God, I've got to stop this. You know, kids are missing out. That type of thing. So I thought, right, bite the bullet. Oh, that's a squaddy saying, isn't it? Bite the bullet. And do something about it. So I joined my local gym.
Yeah.
It was the Dome.
Big step.
Oh, God, it was huge. It was so scary. I had, because I had to wear shorts. People were looking. I kind of like, my God. But I thought, because I'd not done phys for a long while, because I had a couple of surgeries. I need to get back into phys. My first class was an elderly aerobics class. And I met some amazing people, and they were all positive. And I thought, well, literally dipping your toe in the water because it's not going to be too, excessive, too hard. And you know, I really, really liked it. And it was like the best thing ever. And the way it made me feel, it was like, oh, I've actually done it. Surprised myself. I made a couple of buddies. A lot of my friends are like in their 60s, 70s. You know,
some characters.
I've got some characters. Some of them are teaching me to learn to cook because I still can't cook. And I thought, oh, you know, I'll try something else.
Yeah.
So the next day I went back and I tried another class and I thought, oh, actually, it was really, really good. And some of the stuff that I can't do, I kind of like wing it. So if there's like lunges or something, I'll just lay on my back and do leg raises or sit-ups or some sort of ab work. And I got hooked. So from there, I was like, right, I need more. I need more. And I tried bigger and better classes. So now I'll do a body pump. I'll do spinning.
That's awesome.
Spinning, one leg. Well, for months I was asking for a recumbent bike because I needed to work it. But because there were certain chains I had to go through, it, it took a bit long. And I thought, well, one day my friend Joyce, who's teaching me to cook, she went on the bike and I thought, oh, give it a go. It wasn't a class, but I thought, give it a go. And I was having issues still with the leg because the socket pushes against the bike seat and it comes off. And I thought, oh, for God's sake. So I just took it off and I thought, give it a go. I thought, oh, it worked. And when you pedal, it follows you through. It doesn't just stop if you
the
stop pedaling.
The weight and momentum takes the pedal around.
That's what I was looking for. And I thought, oh. So I did it sat down and did a different levels. And I thought, try it standing up on one leg. I thought, pushing the boat out here. But I tried it and I was like, no effing way. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Yeah. So I did a couple of sessions with it just by myself. And then I plucked up the courage to do a class. And I explained that, you know, I'm a bit nervous, probably won't be able to keep up. She goes, just do what you can.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, and the amount of sweat that came off. Oh, I loved it. It was absolutely incredible. And it got the old cardio going because, again, for the lack of running. And I was hooked. So now I do like a pre-workout of weights before a Synergy class, before another class after that. And sometimes I've got four classes in a day and I'll get home at lunchtime. But the reason why I go is because my house is like a prison and I can't get around it.
Yeah.
And so something good has come out of something rubbish.
Yeah.
And again, we're still ongoing with getting it adapted.
Yeah. ABF, if you're listening, I'm coming for you.
I hope so. Yeah. Two years in of it and it's just been shit canned.
Yeah.
So really bad. And that's having really kind of like negative on my mental health again. And I can feel myself slipping down. And I don't want to go down that route.
Yeah,
I really can't.
Yeah.
But it's getting harder and harder to kind of stay positive and keep momentum going. But it's hard.
Yeah, 100%. I can feel it. Well, I'm going to do everything I can within my realm of power and I'll just pull in people and we'll get it sorted. As for charities, the reason how we got together to do this was through Emma's charity, Style for Soldiers.
Oh, Emma's amazing.
Yeah.
She's absolutely amazing.
I'm just hearing amazing things from her and her charity and the guys that have sort of helped.
Yeah. I first heard of Emma when I was at Headley and she visited a couple of times, but I was not in a great place. I still had my leg and normally at the end of the day, after dinner, you just go to your room and shut the world out. And I missed out on a couple of visits when she was there. And it wasn't until I actually had my amputation that the head started clearing that I got in touch with Emma via another member.
Yeah.
And she opened me with, you know, open arms, said, yeah, come to this. And my first real meeting with her was a small summer party.
Yep.
And it's absolutely beautiful. People were dressed up. It was like going to a mess do. And that's what I've missed since being out of the army. Yeah. So a bit of glam, bit of lippy, go have a nice dinner and meet like-minded people. Yeah. And it was like a little reunion because you'd met through
Headley Court. And
through Headley, And I've been a member now for, I think, the last 3 years.
That's awesome.
But my favourite time is in the summer, puts on a Woburn trip, Woburn Safari Park, and the kids can come along, and these kids can see other like-minded children, and they can talk about their experiences and how it's affected their family, and know that they're not the only people going through the same thing.
Well, I suppose in their circle of friends or at their school, there's probably no one else with a parent that has a prosthetic or a life-changing injury, so it's good for them just to
given the opportunity to see other like-minded people.
And they're not on their own.
And again, seeing people with injuries that are slightly different mm-hmm. because everybody's got their own, you know, every parent's got their own injury. Mm-hmm. But to have that bond with somebody else to talk about how they feel, because you can talk to other kids and you just not know, but to have somebody to be in the same situation as you has been really beneficial. Beneficial.
That's really good. That's really good.
It's amazing.
What's now? What's on the cards for you? Invictus Games?
Well, yes. Well,
potentially.
Well, when I was doing the getting back into the fitness, mm-hmm. and I thought, you know, carrying on, I get emails about what's going on and whatnot, and I had an Invictus email, and mm-hmm. I thought, actually, give it a go. I mean, I'm back in the gym. I thought, wing it. Put down some things I'd never tried. I've never tried rowing. I've never really tried running.
Yeah,
I didn't have a reason to.
Sure.
And was really lucky to do the Sheffield Games.
All right.
In the summer, and thought
How'd
nothing.
You find that?
Thought nothing of it. Oh, do you know what? It was incredible. My kids, you know, like a live Facebook thing.
Yeah.
Kids got to see me run. And I cried at the end. I was like, oh my God, it's the first time I'd run 100 metres.
That's
I was hanging out my arse. But the coach was at the end because he knew I'd had, again, people, different people watching and looking and the anxiety. And I got to the end and I just burst into tears and I was like, my kids have just seen me run. And it was incredible. And that was it for me. I was done. I was like, well, happy with that. I'm sorted. And then a couple of months later, I get an email saying that you've been accepted to the Invictus Games. I was like, oh.
Shit.
I'm completely honoured and totally gobsmacked that they see something in me that I could do. But I was speechless. I was thinking, my God, I've actually got to do what I've said I'm going to do now. So, again, going to the gym now, I've got a purpose.
Sure, a goal.
And so I have to do this. And that's what's keeping me going. Because I think I would have stopped a while ago with the health situation. But I need to go there because a lot of people are going to see me in a swimsuit. And it ain't a pretty sight. I want to just tone in some wobbly bits. But, it's a massive, massive mental boost, physical boost, an all-round something positive. And that's what the Invictus has given me. So
that's brilliant.
I can't thank
you. So what are you doing? Do you know yet? Or like a pick and mix and stuff?
A bit of pick and mix, try anything once. I'm doing swimming, so 50 metres 50 metres front, 50 metres back, 50 metres breast, 100 metres freestyle, probably not a relay, I don't know, it depends on timings and stuff. Then I've got athletics, I've got shot put discus, 100 metres, 200 metres, 400 metres.
That's brilliant.
And I'm like, what? Oh, and rowing, indoor rowing.
So you pretty much ticked every box they had.
Yeah. The only one I'm a bit gutted I didn't tick was cycling because I'm doing this spinning now. Mm-hmm. I hadn't done it before and I was thinking, oh, I'm really good. And I felt really, really good with doing it. Mm-hmm. So if I could wind back the time and do cycling.
Is there no way of...
I don't think there is and I've not really trained for it. I just do spin and they say stand or sit and smash it for 30 seconds and 15 seconds rest and smash it again. Yeah. And I'm like, but it's an incredible honour to be chosen for the Invictus That's Games because there's so many amazing people, but so many little spaces.
Yeah, yeah. That's
amazing. As if it goes ahead.
Yeah, with the old corona.
And everything starts to shut down now and cancel and postpone.
Well, they'll just put it back, surely. It's not annual, surely it's not an annual game, is it?
It's a two-yearly thing.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they'll push... If it is cancelled, push back to actually, then you can just...
We'll just man up and crack on.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, just don't breathe over anyone. Loads of alcohol gel. Hand wash, it's all good.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. And not only that, like, your kids get to watch you do it.
My kids.
When it comes to sports day, there's no excuse for them now, is there?
Oh, do you know what? I'm so excited because, again, they've only seen me really run around once in a race. But with the leg I've got now, you know, we'll walk to the park and I'll swap legs and then we'll play TIG.
That's awesome.
And that is like, something little, but it's huge in our family.
It's probably something
you
never think you'll do again immediately post-op, I can imagine.
I didn't think I'd even walk,
let
alone run, swim, bloody row.
Rowing. Yeah.
Rowing on one leg is a killer.
I can imagine. Rowing on two legs is a killer.
my poor leg.
Yeah.
But it's an incredible opportunity, and I'm so, so looking forward to it and thankful for for help here for choosing us.
That's awesome. So moving forward, obviously we've covered Invictus Games. It might be this year, might be next year. What else is on the cards right now?
Right now, I've not really looking too far ahead because I'm kind of at a standstill.
Yeah.
Because of my living the accommodation, house, yeah. And when I left the army, I was gonna do. I trained as a phlebotomist, so right. I've actually got a civilian qualification.
Yeah, yeah.
So I put my training into that, and my idea was get the house done,
yeah.
And then go back into work because sure. The last thing I wanted to do was find a really cushy little job, really job that I enjoy. Mm-hmm. Move out for like 4 to 6 months and then have to leave work early to pick them up, to pick kids up from school or drop off because we're going to be out of the catchment area trying to get a rented accommodation.
Yeah.
And the last thing I wanted to do was get a job and then mess them around.
Sure.
So I've postponed finding a job.
Yeah.
And that job has turned, that postponement's turned into 6 months, turned into a year, 18 months, 2 years now. And I can't see anything happening unless my house is adapted.
Yeah.
I can't see anything apart from the Invictus thing that's happening.
Yeah.
And as negative as I don't want to sound negative about it.
Sure.
But once the Invictus is over, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
I'm still stuck in that routine.
Yeah.
And I'm worried that when the Invictus is done and dusted, I won't have that momentum to go back to the gym because of all that negativity and then staying stuck in that house.
Yeah.
And, oh, it's a vicious cycle and I don't want to do it.
It is. Right, well, like I said before, we're going to do everything in our power, get the charities together and see what we can do.
Oh, it's not the charities, it's DIO. But I'm not going to say any more about that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a right giggle.